Sorry.
Wow. If you are interested in signing on.
Firm. Love this thing. Good morning, everyone. I would like to call the meeting of the Ways and Means order. We do have a quorum. First on the agenda is approval of last week's extensive minutes. Representative Ogbaje, have you had a chance to review the minutes?
Yes, Mr. Chair. So moved.
Thank you. All those in favor of approving the minutes, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Minutes are approved. Thank you. The minutes for February 10th, 2025. Members, we had planned to hear a bill today, but I think you've all been informed that that bill is not on the agenda today. We had some attendance issues, so we'll postpone that for another meeting. That leaves our entire time this morning to really focus on fiscal notes. I think everyone in this room knows, the process of producing and approving fiscal notes is one that's been a complex, rather dicey issue over the last number of years. The Legislative Budget Office was established as a way to try and make that a little more independent, but even that process has not really worked all that well. We are today going to be using the paid family medical leave bill as an example of the fiscal note process. We're not really here to debate that bill. We're really here to analyze and debate what we might be able to do to make this process function more effectively. You know, we have the saying around here that some bills seem to suffer death by fiscal note. When the fiscal note is negative in terms of perspective of a bill passing. On the other hand, sometimes it seems that the fiscal notes are a little too rosy, that they support a bill at a time when it really doesn't reveal all of the fiscal impacts of a bill. So, you know, it behooves us all as legislators to want to have accurate, timely fiscal notes. We do better work when we have good information, and we are dependent on the agencies and working through the LBO to give us the information we need in a timely fashion. With that, we're going to start out with a presentation by the LBO. And welcome, Director Larson. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your presentation.
Chair Torkelson and members, my name is Christian Larson, Director of the Legislative Budget Office. Can everyone hear me okay? I was asked to come before you today to speak about the fiscal notes for the paid leave law developed in the 2024 legislative session. These were fiscal notes proposing changes to the 2023 session law, Chapter 59. Specifically, the House Ways and Means Committee reviewed House File 5363 and the associated fiscal note in the 2024 legislative session. A memorandum on the topic is provided as part of your packets, as well as the slides for this presentation. It's important as we begin this conversation to note that we are not discussing the paid leave program as it stands today, but rather we were focusing on the paid leave law as it was enacted in the 2023 legislative session and any proposed changes that were proposed during the 2024 legislative session. So it's measuring the difference between what was enacted in 2023 and what was proposed during the 2024 legislative session. Please feel free to stop me at any time to ask questions. Also, there'll be time for questions at the end of the presentation. In today's discussion, we'll walk through the background information regarding the development of the paid leave law fiscal notes, talk about challenges and concerns with the fiscal note, those raised by members, and we'll talk about suggestions for addressing the challenges presented with these fiscal notes and other similarly situated fiscal notes. Just some important background. The paid leave law was originally passed in the 2023 legislative session, and benefit payments and premium collection is scheduled to start on January 1, 2026. The fiscal note methodology used prior to the 2024 legislative session used a labor microsimulation model predicting worker leave behavior that was distributed by the U.S. Department of Labor. The 2023 enacting legislation for the paid leave law required an actuarial analysis to determine actuarial soundness. That actuarial analysis was released in October of 2023 and included two scenarios for contributions or premium collection. The first was rates as defined in statute of 0.7% in year one and adjusted based on a formula in year two and beyond, based on prior year usage, fund balancings of that nature. In an alternative scenario, that assumed a contribution rate of 0.78% in the first year and consistent contribution rates of 0.78% for the first 3 years, and then an increase to 0.83% moving forward in the enacting legislation. And finally, as we prepared for fiscal notice to come in during the 2024 legislative session, the Legislative Budget Office met with Deed to kind of talk about plans for how to address this fiscal note. And in that meeting, Deed described some challenges and some concerns in terms about how to approach fiscal note development. Should they rely on the microsimulation model from the Department of Labor? Should they rely on future actuarial analyses to estimate changes to the law? And both which came with resource challenges in terms of the microsimulation model, or what was called the Workers Plus model. It was really resource intensive for staff, and then actuarial analyses required additional payments to the actuary to develop those estimates. So that was discussed as kind of leading into the development of fiscal notice during the 2024 legislative session. Also, in terms of a little bit of background, just what are expectations for fiscal notes? Fiscal notes are governed really in two places. They're governed in statute, in Minnesota statute 3.98. It's a really broad, high-level expectation for fiscal notes, describe what needs to be in a fiscal note, who can request one, things of that nature, and then the uniform standards and procedures for fiscal notes, or the fiscal note uniform standards and procedures. This is a more detailed set of expectations for fiscal notes, both standards and a process for how to reach those standards. And those are approved by the Legislative Budget Office Oversight Commission. That's a bipartisan, bicameral commission, four members from the House, four members from the Senate, whose responsibility is to approve the fiscal note standards and procedures. When you boil down the fiscal note uniform standards and procedures, it really is a few things that a fiscal note has to have. Now, they're much more detailed than this, but generally, it needs to be an estimate of the fiscal effect from the current law-based budget. So traditionally, that means the enacted budget, most recent enacted budget, or the budget as provided in the most recent budget and economic forecast. Assumptions that need to be reasonable, accurate, and objective. And assumptions and methodologies provided in the fiscal note need to be sufficient to support the fiscal estimates provided in that fiscal note. Really, it should be a standalone document that the reader should be able to read and say, okay, I understand why the numbers say what they say. So we'll now walk through the challenges with the 2024 paid leave law fiscal notes. And it really all revolves around setting a baseline, like where are you measuring that baseline from, and any changes in baseline assumptions. And so that's really, we'll talk about three different cases where that came to be a challenge. I think that caused concern for members and confusion in terms of what information is provided in the fiscal note. First, there's no apparent and obvious baseline from which to measure for the paid leave law 2024 legislative session. Superman. I will talk more in detail about what this is in a minute, but again, it's always a fiscal has to measure from that current law base. And for the paid leave law, the question was for 2024 legislative session, what was the current law base? Second, there's refinement of agency interpretation of the paid leave law following the 2023 legislative session, and this really evolved around the 7-day qualifying event. In this case, the question was, did the original law require a 7-day qualifying event? And there was just a kind of a refinement of that understanding from the agency's perspective after the law passed. And so that I think caused some confusion in terms of the fiscal note. And finally, Deed assumed the use of permissive authority to adjust the first year premium rate, which again caused some confusion as we looked at the fiscal note. So we think about establishing the baseline. Again, why was this a challenge for the paid leave law program? Fiscal notes are always measured from that current law base, and there wasn't an obvious current law base for this program at the time. So we had the end of session 2023 fiscal estimates, what was produced from the 2023 legislative session fiscal notes. So that's one option for the base for this fiscal note. Again, the paid leave law as enacted in 2023 required an actuarial analysis evaluating the program activity. And that was released in October of 2023. And so that's another option for the base. So do you go off the enacted budget or do you use a more recent estimate, which is statutorily required as the baseline? The law is an entitlement program. So traditionally we would use the most recent forecasted numbers for a fiscal note estimate. In this case, it wasn't included in the the most recent forecast, but as it wasn't a general fund program, so that wasn't inherently included in the forecast. So the question then is, do you use that end of session 2023 enacted budget, or do you use the 2024, the October 2023 actuarial analysis? In the end, through conversations with Deed, through conversations with MMB, conversations with House and Senate fiscal staff, and certainly internal conversations, we determined that that October 23 actuarial analysis made the most sense to use as the baseline for fiscal notes in 2024. The advantages being it's the most recent and likely the most accurate fiscal estimate we have for the program, and it was consistent with practice for other entitlement programs, again, using that most recent kind of forecast, even though it's not the budget and economic forecast, at that time, that was the most recent kind of estimate we have. Now, just to be clear, this program was included in the most recent November forecast, and so that issue has been resolved. And then we didn't know this at the time, but another kind of advantage of using the October actuarial analysis is that the fiscal notes developed in the 2024 session relied on updated actuarial analyses from Milman, who created the October actuarial analysis. And so if you're using a baseline and measuring against a new estimate, if you have a consistent methodology between those two kind of ways of measuring, then you're really measuring the changes in what was required of those new laws. If we would go back and say we're going to measure from the end of session the end of session enacted budget and then use an updated actuarial analysis, you are measuring somewhat changes in assumptions between what was required in the enacted budget and what was proposed in 2024, but you're also measuring the changes in methodology. And so it's not exactly an apples-to-apples comparison, as opposed to making sure you're using that actuarial analysis as both the baseline and the future projection. So that was the advantage. But the big disadvantage, and what caused a lot of, I think, concern, is that there was then gaps in information from what was the understood budget at the end of the 2023 legislation and what was that new baseline. So what the fiscal note wouldn't carry by resetting the baseline is what was the old baseline and what's the new baseline, what's the difference there. And I think that really drove the challenges and concerns. So that's kind of the piece about defining baseline and how that was challenging for this particular fiscal note. Second, we had the refinement of agency assumptions of the paid leave law, and this really focused on the 7-day qualifying event and essentially asking the question, is there a waiting period to receive benefits? When the 2023 fiscal note was developed in the enacting legislation and I think understood by members, the law did not have a 7-day waiting period to receive benefits. You had to have a 7-day qualifying event to become eligible for benefits, but the fiscal note for 2023, and I think legislative understanding at the time, was you would receive retro pay essentially for those first 7 days of your qualifying event. The October actuarial analysis, when it came out, through Deed's kind of refinement of their understanding of the assumptions, was those first 7 days were not actually paid days, and you didn't start receiving benefit payments until day 8. And so in terms of what that means for the fiscal note, again, is what are we measuring from? What's the baseline? So the new baseline said those first 7 days were not paid, and so any change, and in the 2024 language clarified that those would be paid days. So you're now adding back in the cost of those first 7 days into the cost of the change from baseline to this proposed change. And so that technically is a new cost per the fiscal note. And the question is, from legislative understanding, is that a new cost? So I think that was also a challenge in terms of how that fiscal note was received. And finally, it was the exercising of permissive authority to adjust the first-year premium rate that also caused some concern and confusion. The premium was established in the 2023 enacting legislation, had a first-year premium rate of 0.7% for family and medical benefits for the employers that participated in the family and medical benefits. And the second year beyond was determined by a formula with a cap of up to 1.2% of taxable wages. And the rate would fluctuate year to year depending on prior year usage and the formula that was in statute. In the enacting legislation allowed for adjustment to premium rates based on an actuarial analysis if the program was found to be not actuarially sound within the limits placed in statute. Now, it's unclear if the reading of that permissive language allowed for the first year premium rate to be adjusted or if it was the second year and beyond. Deed interpreted that language to say that the premium rate for the first year and beyond could be adjusted based on the findings of that actuarial analysis. So that would reset the baseline. And the actuarial analysis again suggested provide two scenarios. Scenario one, 0.7% premium rate in year one and then a fluctuating after that, and a 0.78%, and the alternative scenario assumed a 0.78% premium rate, more flat. And in the fiscal note, deed assumed that they would therefore, like, under, if no law change happened in the 2024 legislative session, if they were to enact the law, then 2023 law, they would use this authority to change the first year premium rate. And again, the challenge with this is, again, we're missing the gap of information is like, what is the difference of premiums collected between 0.7 and 0.78 in that first year? And so that was not what was in the fiscal note. And so that, again, I think led to challenges and concerns with the information provided. So again, it's a resetting of the baseline. And then if we set the baseline, what information isn't included? So I think the question then is, how do we move forward and how do we address this type of situation in the future? And as we reviewed both internally from the Legislative Budget Office, but also in communicating with the agency, communicating with other offices, with MMB, with House and Senate Fiscal Staff, we've developed some suggested ways to move forward and hopefully address some of these situations in the future. First, we reviewed our communication with the agency on the fiscal note review, and it was extensive. We have a 35-page email chain going back and forth about this fiscal note. So we know the communication was extensive. I think we could have been much earlier in the process saying, these are the things we need to see for this fiscal note to meet standards. And so if we could have that conversation really early in the process, then it's not so much of a back and forth of what needs to get in the fiscal note and identifying those gaps of information that we kind of described here today. Second, I think there's an opportunity for the Legislative Budget Office to provide more detailed analysis in certain situations. And one of those situations is the one we're talking about today, which is similar to the paid family law fiscal notes in 2024. And that's in cases where the fiscal note technically we think meets standards, but there's information that could be provided that is useful for understanding the full fiscal effect in the bill. In this case, perhaps a memo providing detailed information of what was the old base and what's the new base, and the change between the old base and the new base would have supported the conversation of the legislature. So that's one scenario where the Legislative Budget Office could provide additional analysis and research, where we historically haven't engaged in that kind of sharing of information with the legislature. We've very much focused on reviewing the fiscal notes. Another situation, which I don't think is really what we're talking about in terms of the paid leave law, is situations where the fiscal note does not meet standards, where the Legislative Budget Office determines the fiscal note does not meet standards. In that case, what are the avenues to move forward? Currently, under the Uniform Standards and Procedures, we have the authority to release a fiscal note as unapproved. So all the fiscal notes the Legislative Budget Office has released up until this point in our history, so our 5.5 sessions, we've worked with agencies to get to something that we think meets standards. And in cases where we haven't met standards, we just don't sign off. That's the authority that we've exercised. We do have the authority under our standards and procedures to release a fiscal note unapproved and then provide a cover memo that states the concerns we have with that fiscal note or to provide additional estimates if we think we have the information available to do that. We've been hesitant to kind of step into that space. Again, we do have that authority, but we've just been hesitant for a couple reasons. And the first is really practical. The first is a timing issue. We're traditionally working with an agency up until the night before on many fiscal notes or even hours before a committee hearing to make sure that that note meets standards and gets out to the committee. If we were to say we're going to start to pivot and start to develop our own estimates, we would have to do that earlier in the process and say, okay, we need to start collecting the information. We need to make our own estimate or provide the additional information we think useful to understand why we don't think this fiscal note meets standards. Again, we can do that kind of in unison. We just have to think about how we use resources in the office and kind of the process we have set up. It'd be a little bit change of how we approach things historically. The second issue is more about kind of what does a fiscal note mean? So historically, a fiscal note has been released only when it meets standards, and therefore, when a legislator sees a fiscal note, they know the Legislative Budget Office has determined that it meets the standards as established in the Uniform Standards and Procedures. If we start releasing fiscal notes as unapproved, does it have that same weight? Then do all fiscal notes get devalued a little bit because you don't, like, am I looking at an approved one or not? Now, certainly there would be documentation that says this is unapproved, and there'd be a cover memo that explains the concerns. But we've been hesitant to kind of step into that space for those two reasons. We also think it's important for significant fiscal notes for new programs, for agencies to engage early in the process to develop fiscal estimates, providing preliminary assumptions and outlined approach to the fiscal assumptions to the Legislative Budget Office as early as possible. So again, we met with the agency early in this case to say, we know this will be a challenge, how are we going to approach it? And certainly the agency engaged in that and said, well, we are struggling with this too, thinking about what does baseline mean, these type of things. The earlier we can have those assumptions, those preliminary assumptions, again, we can identify the gaps in information. And that's when we can start to have communication with different, the fiscal staff, with members, whatever else it might be, to make sure that the right information is getting to the folks that need it, so that when the fiscal comes out, it's understood what's in there. There's less concern about kind of the contents. We also think that agencies should communicate with legislative members and staff regarding substantial changes to assumptions related to existing programs. And the LBO should be included in those communications, and this should happen prior to the fiscal note being released. Again, in this case, it would have been really useful to have communication going to committee leadership, to the fiscal staff to say, again, this is what's in the fiscal note, and this is what then for what's not in the fiscal note, and how do we get you the information that's not in there that would be useful for understanding the full fiscal effect of the program. We think it's useful for the legislature and the Legislative Budget Office Oversight Commission to reiterate the importance of fiscal notes being developed independent of political considerations. That's not a statement that says that this fiscal note was developed with political considerations in place, but rather when this is made public and members and legislative leadership make sure that it's understood that this is the expectation, when the Legislative Budget Office then reaches out to agencies and says, we have these concerns, we see these updates, we need to see this information, we need this data, whatever it is, it holds more weight because it's understood that we're not just making this, we're not making things up. We really need to see this so the legislature is comfortable with what's being shared. It's in the Uniform Standards and Procedures that these are to be objective and all that exists. It's just making sure that that's reiterated, provides us support when we are working with agencies. We think it's useful for the Legislative Budget Office Oversight Commission to consider developing a working group, and this would be a working group of state entities that complete fiscal notes, House and Senate nonpartisan staff, MMB, and our office, to look at a few different cases. And should there be special standards and procedures in the fiscal uniform standards and procedures to address cases where assumptions are drastically changing? Should there be a documented process that says if assumptions between 1 year's fiscal notes and the next year's fiscal notes are going to change substantially, or if assumptions are changing drastically in the forecast, should there be some special process that needs to take place so we know that, just to handle kind of issues that we've seen in this particular fiscal note? We also think in cases where there's substantially complex or new programs, it might be useful to have specific standards, say that here's a particular process you have to follow. And finally, in situations that may require a third, or that might benefit or require a third party to develop an estimate for a fiscal note, what are the expectations on that? Do agencies have a requirement, or what is a reasonable expectation for agencies to go back to a third party if that's how the estimates have been developed in the past, I think is a question for the Oversight Commission to kind of wrestle with. And finally, we believe it's useful for DEA to share their plans for estimating the fiscal impacts of the paid leave law for the 2025 and beyond, just so that we have a clear understanding of this is the approach. Now, the baseline issue has more or less been solved in that we have the paid leave program included in the forecast. But the question is, how do we estimate changes to that law if there's changes proposed this year? What's the plan to handle those type of estimates? And from there, I'm happy to stand for any questions.
Well, thank you, Mr. Larson. Before I go to other members, could you just review the different types of fiscal notes that are available to legislators as we imagine what a bill might look like? How can you help us with the fiscal note types?
Yeah, so there's three types of fiscal notes. The first is what we mostly think of as fiscal notes. We call those regular fiscal notes, but it's fiscal notes on enacted legislation, on proposed legislation that can be acted upon by the legislature. So an introduced bill, an engrossed version of a bill, an amendment, that's a regular fiscal note. There's unofficial fiscal notes, and those are fiscal notes on draft legislation. I should clarify, so a regular fiscal note, those requests are made on behalf of the chair of the committee for which the bill resides, or the chair of the Ways and Means Committee, or the chair of the Senate Finance Committee. Those are the members that can request a regular fiscal note. So once a legislation has been introduced, the request comes on behalf of a chair of a committee. An unofficial fiscal note can be requested by any member, and those are on draft legislation. So long as a bill is not introduced, a request can come in on draft legislation. And then there's classified unofficial fiscal notes. And these are fiscal notes, again, on draft legislation that has not been considered by a committee, so not even introduced, but rather if someone has provided the information to a committee just to consider, that's not eligible for a classified fiscal note request. So a classified fiscal note request can come on behalf of any member, and that information that's included, both the bill language and the fiscal note that gets produced, has to remain private, non-public data. The only individuals that see that information are the member who makes the request, the fiscal analyst who makes the request into the fiscal note tracking system, the IT system we use to facilitate the fiscal note process on behalf of the member, the Legislative Budget Office, and then the agencies assigned to that fiscal note. And everyone's required to keep that law, that information private, non-public, and then when it gets released, it only goes to the member that information isn't distributed publicly. Now, if a bill then later is, if that language is later considered, is introduced or part of an amendment or anything like that, that fiscal note does become public information.
Thank you for that, Mr. Larson. You may not be able to answer this in detail, but in the case of the paid family medical leave bill, were these various types of fiscal notes utilized?
So there were both regular fiscal note requests on language that was introduced, and there was unofficial requests made on a version of the law that was the language that was later considered, but also other proposed changes in the 2024 legislative session that didn't later become introduced language.
But to your knowledge, no private, non-public fiscal note was requested?
So I can't speak to that.
I figured that. So yeah, I just thought I'd ask. So. Well, thank you for that information. We'll go to member questions now, starting with Representative Baker.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Director Larson, thank you again for coming forward. I learned a lot. As I was the lead on the Workforce Committee 2 years ago, through the process of really, you know, digging into the paid family discussion, and it is, again, with, as you said it well, very complex. There really wasn't much to work from to start with, so I understand and appreciate the challenges. Knowing what you have sort of said now publicly, Director, do you need the ability to, or do you already have the authority to do sort of a timeout here? We don't have this right. I think what I'm hearing you say here this session is sort of reflecting on the fiscal note process. We could have done better here, as all of us. And I think, again, your honest work on this, do you have currently or the ability to say you don't approve them? I know you can say that we don't approve them, but should you have a larger voice and maybe coming to certain committees, maybe it's Ways and Means, because everything around the fiscal note must have a ways sort of a pathway, whether it's meeting with the chair and the lead or something. I'm just wondering, in hindsight now, should we call those unofficial fiscal notes or those unapproved in a louder voice than maybe what we learned in this situation?
Mr. Larson.
Chair Torkelson, Mr. Baker. I think it's a really good question. I think most folks don't hear, but our office is still relatively new. This is our sixth session, so we've been around for six sessions, and we definitely have learned some things along the way. I think in terms of situations where we have problems, either with getting to estimates we think are meet standards, or if in the rare cases where agencies aren't responding, and I will caveat all of this that our general experience is that agencies are responsive and that agencies do engage, and there's a lot of work that happens in the fiscal process, and so that isn't it's not a giant concern that we have. But in those cases where we do have agencies either not responsive or where we come to a point where we really can't come to an agreement on what meets standards for a reasonable, accurate estimate, there is at times useful conversations to have either with leadership of a committee or publicly regarding the development of the fiscal note. Now, we have to be really thoughtful about our relationships with our agencies and our state entities. Is really important that we're working daily and communicating daily or nearly daily with a lot of folks. We need to have those really good working relationships. And so we don't want our relationship to be consistently we're dropping the hammer and coming down all the time. Like that won't be productive in terms of making sure the fiscal process works really well. But there are times, I think, when we have challenges and discussions at a public dialogue of what might those concerns be and what Maybe the agency has a really good reason for not wanting to come off an estimate, but we also think we have a really good reason, and maybe there's a public discussion about that that's really useful for the legislature to consider in terms of having maybe more information as opposed to just what comes out in the fiscal note. At the same time, we want to make sure that we maintain our responsibility. We've very much seen ourselves as umpires in the process, of the fiscal note process, and so we're just calling balls and strikes. Does that meet standards? Does it not meet standards? For us to kind of move beyond that, that would be a little bit further than we've gone in the past. I think in some situations that makes sense, and for the majority of the time, the process as set up works well.
A follow-up, Representative Baker?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I appreciate that, Director Larson. You know, we're still at the sort of the growing pains of the LBO, and I appreciate that. And I understand that relationships with agencies are complex, and I do know many times that you work very well together and cooperatively, and you're working on things late at night to get them delivered. But I just know that going through this process in this size of a concept, mandate, new law change was enormous. But I want to make sure as we go forward, we have that sense of how big this really is from an office that we're all also getting to know you better and the work that you have to do in a nonpartisan in a manner. And to that, my final question right now, Mr. Chair, there was a couple of fiscal notes that I had requested back in 2024 on a bill that I had introduced. Didn't get a bill hearing on it, but I was always looking for a bill fiscal note on what it would cost to make a change to paid family. I put that back in February, and from that whole session, I never did receive it. My question to you is, if members like me or others in the future have issues like that, what more do you think the LBO office could do to try to make sure I get communicated to, or any member, or your authority to say you need to get that fiscal note out to a member for whatever reason? Should that maybe have been something that we could have looked at as well?
Director Larson.
Chair Torkelson, Representative Baker, thank you for the question. I think in terms of kind of the specifics of this case, I think we could become better at communicating when there's a holdup, when things are being held up. We do communicate to agencies that all active requests are expected to be completed. The question is, and there always is prioritization that happens during session, and so when you, especially you get to near the first and second deadline, there's a lot of prioritization. We have more requests that can be completed in a given week. For agencies, our offices traditionally can get through them, but there is always going to be a resource pinch during those kind of times. But at the same time, we never suggest that active requests are not needed. In fact, we tell them that these are active requests and in fact, do need to be completed. In terms of how to kind of address situations when that's not taking place, I think certainly we can do a better job of communicating to members directly. We have been relatively, I think, kind of stand back. We just haven't done a ton of outreach to members in terms of we really focus on our process. And I think that's a place for us to grow. In terms of how to address and having agencies make sure they do complete, there's not a lot of tools in our toolbox that allows us to force completion of a fiscal note. And I'm not sure there's a really good policy answer to that, that there is some way to have that kind of enforcing mechanism in our office. But that's just the reality of we can't say, hey, you have to complete. I mean, we say that, but if you say that, then what's the next step? There's just not a really good mechanism to enforce that.
Thank you. Our Representative Nash has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've got a couple questions, actually. So, Director Larson, thanks for being here today. I appreciate the work that you do. You've always been very helpful when I need fiscal notes, and I always find them to be pretty solid. If you would help me, Mr. Chair and Director Larson, you said you had several pillars that you had early on in your presentation. I got reasonable, accurate, and I may have forgotten to write down the other ones because my brain is still under caffeinated. So would you mind just jump-starting the conversation with the other pillars?
Director Larson.
Chair Torkelson, Representative Nash. Yeah, so it's fiscal notes must be reasonable, accurate, and objective, and that the assumptions and methodology provided need to provide sufficient detail to support the fiscal estimates.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And to this particular fiscal note, Director Larson, I was in Ways and Means. I've been on the committee for quite some time now, and I remember the paid family medical discussion, and I remember that there were lots of stops and starts, and our math doesn't work. I remember that was, I think it was last year, because I remember Assistant Commissioner Rowe was coming to present, and then we looked at the fiscal note compared to the language of a latest engrossed bill, and then Representative Garofalo pointed out that the math just didn't work. So to that, I'm trying to figure out how that got out of sync with the flurry of things that were going on overnight. Can you maybe help me understand how we got there? Because I've always meant to ask you, because from my perspective, it was that the authors and Deed and the departments were trying to move faster than you could when you're trying to maintain those pillars of reasonable, accurate, objective. If you would maybe detail some of that, if you remember it. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Director Larson.
Director Torkelson, Representative Nash. Yeah, so we have staff that works on these individual bills, but here's my understanding, and if we need to kind of follow up on this, we certainly will. But the hearing was scheduled, I think, on a Friday or something, to be heard of a fiscal note, and then it turned out that the fiscal note was made on faulty assumptions, and a new fiscal note had to be created. The next hearing happened on a Monday, perhaps. I can't remember if the fiscal note was completed by then, but then the fiscal note was released after that, I believe. And the situation, I believe, was so as Deed provided updated estimates on the fiscal notes, they went to the actuary and got updated actuarial analyses. And each actuarial analysis had multiple scenarios, and scenario one, scenario two, scenario three type thing. And there was updated actuary analysis created in, I believe, February and again in April. And I think the issue that happened was that the scenario used to update the fiscal note was made on not the set of assumptions that was in the language that was then finally being kind of moved forward. And so that the estimation was between the baseline, that October 2023 actuary analysis, and a future proposed scenario that was released in, I believe, the February updated actuary analyses, but the wrong scenario. And so then the issue was, okay, that was caught, and then it came forward. And we would also have access to those scenarios, and so we were trying to make sure we were also tracking along with. But we also missed that was built on the wrong scenario, and so that was, I believe, the issue with that fiscal note.
You're finished, Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Director Larson, I don't believe was your issue. It was that the bill language was changing very quickly. A lot of the information flowing from Deed was changing very quickly. I remember talking about this. We went into recess, I believe. Both caucuses went off to have a chat. And just this whole process, as I remember it, the accuracy part was lacking, because I don't believe you were getting accurate information on updated DEs on the bill. And I certainly don't think that you were getting accurate information. I remember a fairly lengthy series of questions as it related to IT costs, and I don't know that we ever actually I don't think that the IT costs were ever actually accurately defined for you for the fiscal note, because I believe that those have changed a number of times. And my frustration is that you had said in your presentation too that you try to follow a standard process, and from my take, and I imagine the take of many of the members on our side of the table, this didn't seem like it was a standard process, that it was being moved ahead by the department and the authors and the majority party at the time at lightning speed, faster than you had to be accurate. And I'm just trying to figure out, do you feel like you were given sufficient time to get those things processed so that you could be accurate in your presentation? And this goes to Representative Baker's question of, I believe he called it calling a timeout, because this being as huge of a bill as it is and as widely impactful as it is going to be to the state of Minnesota, as somebody who's sat on this committee for a very long time now, I never felt that that was particularly accurate. So I guess my question is, do you feel like you were given sufficient time to process what I remember to be pages and pages and pages of the fiscal note?
Director Larson.
Chair Torkelson, Representative Nash. In terms of the timing, I think we realize, like, as an office, it's inherent, like, the later you get in session, the less time, the things are going to happen very quickly. And so we understand that's inherently part of the legislative process, especially as you get into May. In terms of having more time, it certainly always is helpful. I think we did a lot of homework in making sure that we understood what was coming and so that we could kind of be prepared early to review and make sure we know what we're looking for in the review. And certainly time helps always to be able to kind of move forward and provide that full accurate analysis. But I also think we understand that there is limitations and that there's a time crunch towards the end of the session, especially.
Thank you, Representative Nash. One more question.
Just one more. And this is not a question, but my observation, since I don't want to put words in his mouth, but I watched this, as did all of us who were on this committee then. Because the speed at which amendments were coming, and they were literally being drafted overnight, particularly when we found inaccuracies, there would be wholesale changes in assumptions. There would be wholesale changes in language. There would be wholesale changes in actuarial assumptions and so on. And I think I'm a big fan of the LBO and always want to give a shout out to our friend, former Representative Bob Vogel, who sort of shepherded this through the process. But we can't expect to get accurate information if departments and administrations and authors and caucuses are barking down on the LBO saying, you got to get this done. I have a hearing tomorrow, but you got to move faster. You got to do this. Because, again, your pillars are reasonable, accurate, objective, and detailed. I found the fiscal note for paid family medical to not be any of those, but not because of your work, but because of what you had been given. And I will detail it again. The tax numbers were all over the map. The assumptions were all over the map. The IT costs, when I pressed the authors, the IT costs were all over the map. And I just don't know how we get an accurate fiscal note out of that process. And I want to make sure that is put on the record, because it was not the fault of the LBO. It was because agencies and priorities of people who were trying to get a bill done were pushing you to do something that there's no way you could have been accurate. So with that, I'll be done. But thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a great example of out kicking your coverage and thinking that that's a good idea. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nash. I'm going to interject here briefly, Director Larson. When a bill is in process, as this bill was, can the author request a classified update to their fiscal note before it goes public?
Chair Torkelson, just to clarify, you're asking, like, once the note's updated, like the status of it, or like what is the estimate as it's being developed?
You have a bill in process, and the author is contemplating major changes to the bill, but doesn't really want to reveal them to the public. Can they request a classified note on their changes?
You could request a classified. Let me look at this. In terms of like how you're amending a bill, and like can you classify request, historically. Just 1 second. We'll get back to the committee. We'll make sure we respond and make sure that we check with counsel and research and make sure that we answer that appropriately.
Thank you, Director Larson. We're going to move on. Representative Pinto has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks, Director Larson. And I'll add to Representative Nash's praise of the LBO, and maybe note, I said this in jobs, whenever that was, last week, I guess, time is flying, that I think that only a few Democrats were around on the committee. Several of the committee Democrats were around when the LBO was created, but I believe that there was some resistance on the Democratic side, and I think the time has shown that the LBO was a really good innovation, and agreed to Representative Vogel gets a lot of credit for that. I guess I wanted to ask, so a couple things. I'd heard the comment that the fiscal note, or the final fiscal note for paid family medical leave may not have sort of met the standards of reasonable, accurate, and objective. And of course, I know you've got the memo talking about some complexities and things to work out, but I mean, in the end, did the LBO stand by, and do you feel confident that, in fact, It was reasonable, accurate, and objective with the understanding of this memo that some of those complexities. But if you could just comment on that, Mr. Larson.
Director Larson.
Could you talk us into Representative Pinto? Yes. So we believe it meets standards in the sense that if you measure from the baseline that was provided in the October 2020 actuary analysis and the proposed changes that were proposed in the 2020 legislative session, you can go through and you can say, okay, the seven-day waiting period is included in the fiscal note. You can go through and you can say a change to the small employer calculation is included in the fiscal note. You can say the change from the premium rate of 0.78%, which was the new base, assuming that's how the agency would apply the original law, and the new base. So all of those changes that were a result of the changes in the 2024 legislative set, like that is all in there. This is, I think the question is like, there is inherent gaps by just having the base move. And so that isn't necessarily part of the standards for a fiscal note, but it is seemed like to be really useful information to the legislature to really understand what they had perceived to be the cost of the program to what the new cost is. And so do I think it meets standards? We signed off because we believe it does therefore meet standards because it says what is the current, if this is how we're going to apply it today, even if that was maybe different than we understood it at the end of session. So if as of today, this is how we will apply the bill, and this is how we will apply it once we make those changes. So therefore, it met standards, and we signed off on the note. I will say we also added a substantial comment this time because we do think there was additional information that was useful to the reader. So we could understand that this was a challenge. This fiscal note was a challenge. But technically, we haven't met standards.
Okay. Follow up, Representative.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'll say the seven interventions you've identified, I think, make a lot of sense to me and appreciate that. It seems like this was sort of an opportunity to just identify ways to improve the process. And so thank you. And then speaking of which, I'll just close with this, Mr. Chair. In the course of working through this in the Jobs Committee and all, I think I at least came across a statutory ambiguity that Mr. Chair mentioned this to Lee Stevenson that we may want to look into. And I guess maybe if we can go back to the slide on the presentation that says fiscal note expectations. Yeah, thank you. Members will note that there's a reference there to Minnesota Statute 3.98 and where the standards for fiscal notes are. Those are the fiscal notes that can be requested by chairs of committees and by you, Chair Torkelson. Unofficial fiscal notes are in a completely different part of statute. It's just the Government Data Practices Act basically talking about when something is confidential or not. And I guess this made me think that we do want to be careful, especially as things are getting tight in session and busy, et cetera. You know, if we interpret an unofficial fiscal note to be able to be made by any member of the legislature, you could imagine very quickly agencies getting really tied up and actual fiscal notes requested by chairs could actually sort of get blocked up. And so, and it's not even clear to me in the statute that unofficial fiscal notes, what kind of authority they actually have. And again, I say this as somebody whose caucus is currently not in control, right? The GOP caucus has a plurality of votes. And so I guess, Mr. Chair and Lee Stevenson, I might suggest we may want to look into that because if we're treating unofficial fiscal notes as being the same as fiscal notes, then that could really gum up the works in some challenging ways. Not to say we wouldn't want everybody to get, you know, information, but, you know, if Chair Baker's requesting a fiscal note this year, if I make a whole bunch of unofficial fiscal note requests, I hate to have that sort of gum up the works. I just think something that we want to look at and sort through the statutory ambiguity there for consideration. Thank you, Chair Torkelson. Again, thank you, Director Larson, the LBO.
Thank you, Representative Pinto. Representative Robbins has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for being here, and thank you for the work of the LBO. This was very distressing in real time as we were having this debate, and I remember it well. And I think what's most concerning is helping us understand the interplay between the LBO and the agencies and MMB. Because my understanding, and I was, I think, a freshman when the LBO was created, so maybe I wasn't fully getting everything Bob Vogel was trying to create here, but he was my seatmate on the floor, and we had many conversations about it. And so my understanding is your role is to provide independent analysis to the legislature, and MMB can still provide analysis to the agencies and the executive. Is that correct?
Dr. Larson.
Focus on Representative Robbins. Our responsibility is to provide the fiscal effect of proposed legislation to the legislature. That is our enacting legislation. And in terms of MMB's role in the process, where they used to, I apologize for.
Thank you.
They certainly used to oversee the fiscal process. They do not have an official role in the process at this point, but they certainly, as the fiduciary of the state, work with agencies at times in terms of developing estimates. But in terms of their kind of their direct role in the process, no official role. And I hope I'm not speaking out of place. And imagine MMB can hear speak to that if I am. But as far as that goes, we do find them, like, we'll reach out to them at times when we do have particularly challenging fiscal audits and say, you know, here's what we're struggling with the right kind of information so we can make sure we can ask the right questions and whatever else that might be, and they are responsive.
Follow-up, Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Thank you for that. So it seems to me, and I do get there was a problem with the change in how the seven-day waiting period was being interpreted, and I think that had a material impact on the problem. But to me, the bigger problem was the permissive change in when they could raise the tax. And my understanding was that you and all of us assumed it wouldn't be raised in the first year, and then all of a sudden they just raised it from 0.7 to 0.78. And that not only significantly impacted the fiscal note, but it was an actual real tax increase on our taxpayers. So, and that was the first time it was publicly revealed in the fiscal note. So can you just help me understand when the agency came to you and said, oh, well, we're really going to change this assumption and we're choosing to raise the tax in the first year, even though that wasn't really contemplated, I think, by anyone. Did you push back? If you push back, how did it end up that we still ended up here?
Director Larson.
Chair Tolkison, Representative Robbins. Yeah, so the request was made in April, and the first submitted fiscal request came in a couple weeks after that, I think. It wasn't until kind of a couple back and forth that we got kind of a more detailed, like, explanation of the different pieces, and at that point, we were trying to go, again, from one actual analysis to the next. And at that point, we're like, we cannot figure out how this lines up, right? We can't make this math work. And so at that point, then it was like, yes, yeah, so the new, we are assuming the new rate is this 0.78, this alternative scenario. And then at that point, we expressed concern that the law, we thought, closed at 0.7% the first year. The agency said, we have this permissive authority. We would, and then we came down to it. We did approve it at the end. We went back and forth a number of times. We shared it with fiscal staff and said, hey, you know, this is coming and we're concerned. But in the end, the fiscal note standard is, as the law stands today, that's the baseline. And the agency said, we would exercise this authority to assume a 0.78%, and therefore, that is the baseline. And at that point, we said, okay, then we'll make a note on the front of the fiscal note to identify that as a change in assumption. And it's and identify, we asked the agency to identify that in their fiscal note, that that's a change in assumption. And so that's how we got to that point in the fiscal note, making sure that, one, did it meet standards? We think if that's how the agency is going to apply the law today, if they say this is their authority and they're going to exercise that, that is the baseline. Okay, fine. We will sign off on that and we'll make a note to make sure, because we think that is a substantial change in assumption that members want to know about.
Representative Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And did you agree with that interpretation of the statute, that they were allowed to make that assumption in the change in the first year?
Director Larson.
Chair Tolkison and Representative Robbins, we did not. The way we read the statute is that the statute is referencing, we'll start to say we are not an office of lawyers. That is not how we are. We are policy analysts and budget analysts, and that's how we approach our work. When we read it, when we assumed what the fiscal note, like when we build our, like, hey, this is what we think the fiscal note will look like before it comes in, we assumed we'd see a first year premium rate of 0.7 and measuring whatever future impact that is. So no, we did not assume, that's not how we read it. But the agency said, this is how we implement it. And therefore we don't really have a space to say, well, you won't implement it that way. But rather, if that's how it's going to be implemented, that therefore is the baseline.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Director Representative Robbins.
Thank you. I really appreciate that clarification and that detail, because I think what we're seeing here is that the agency sort of went rogue and they applied a different interpretation than the plain reading of the statute, and I'm very concerned about that. And I think that going forward, we have to be very careful about that. And I would encourage you to use all the tools at your disposal, including not approving fiscal notes. I think that's a very good flag for us as members to realize that our legislative body, the LBO, has concerns, material concerns about what agencies are doing. And so if the fiscal note is unapproved, that will make us sit up and take notice a little more clearly. And if MMB wants to come out with a competing fiscal note, I think they probably still can, and that would be fine if they want to support the agency. But I encourage you to use that as sort of your authority to flag things. I think it's good to work collaboratively. I think in general, most times, you and the agencies work it out really well. But when there are serious considerations for us, I mean, that was a built-in tax increase for our citizens from 0.7 to 0.78 that just appeared out of the ether. And I think that we all in this institution can do better. So I appreciate your work on this, and I hope that the permissiveness going forward will be much clearly outlined in the coming year. I mean, the fact that now we're probably going to be starting from 0.8 is making sure we're clear about that as the debate rolls forward this year, I think, is very important. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Robbins. I have just a couple more questions for Director Larson, then we're going to get the agencies up in front. Representative Claiborne.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair, and to Director Larson. So I thought we were actually discussing the office today and not relitigating paid family medical leave. So my questions to you are really about the agency itself, right? So I'm wondering, can you tell me how many staff do you actually have?
Director Larson.
Chair Duncan, Representative Claiborne, we have 18 staff.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Claiborne.
Okay. And can you please tell me, so your office was enacted the session before I was elected. So can you tell me, at that time of enactment, do you know how many bills or fiscal notes it was anticipated that each analyst would participate in?
Director Larson.
So the ratio.
Chair Dolkson, Representative Claiborne, I do not know that information, what the ratio was.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Claiborne.
Thank you. And can you please tell me, do you know inside each of the agencies that are helping with these fiscal notes, are there dedicated staff within each agency that are your point of contact and would be the individual or person responsible for helping you get whatever fiscal notes you need for that particular agency?
Director Larson.
Chair Dolkson, Representative Claiborne. Yes, we do. We have a fiscal note coordinator in each agency. And then there's also there's certainly a lot of other staff that are involved in the development of fiscal notes. We have a specific contact within each agency that we work with that will then submit on behalf of the agency and that information that comes to us.
Representative Claiborne.
Thank you. And with that coordinator, I'm just trying to get to a depth of expertise, right? So with the coordinator in that agency, so that would be kind of like for us, the legislative contact, but that individual might not be the expert in that particular program or entity, is that correct?
Director Larson.
Representative Claiborne, sometimes. So each agency is kind of set up differently. Sometimes, depending on the agency, sometimes the CFO is the fiscal coordinator. Sometimes it's a specific position that really has that, and then some other duties. Maybe it's a budget director. Oftentimes it's in the finance office, sometimes it's not. Very small agencies, you know, sometimes it's the director. It really depends on how the agencies are set up. And so sometimes they are far removed. If you can think about DHS, they have a strong fiscal staff that responds to fiscal notes, but they're further removed from the departments probably as a bigger agency would be, as opposed to maybe the CFO of a small agency that's set up as a fiscal coordinator. And so each agency is really kind of set up differently, and sometimes they are very involved in terms of understanding the fiscal effects, and sometimes they're a little bit further removed, as you kind of mentioned.
Final question, Representative Claiborne.
Well, I have a whole list of, like, really agency
Representative Claiborne, final question.
Thank you. So with the number of bills that have been introduced, to Chair Pinto's point, right, if you have 18 staff members and your staff are not subject matter experts in each of these programs, right? It is conceivable, with 5,000 bills plus being introduced every year, that each of your staff members could be given upwards to 300 bills to really deep dive in. So tomorrow in committee, I'm going to be seeing a bill, a DE, that I haven't seen before. I haven't received the language myself yet. So I'm trying to figure out exactly, with that kind of ratio and that type of workload and this kind of way that we move bills so quickly, right? The legislature was designed to be a slow and deliberative body, but we're seeing things this year, and I heard from my colleagues across the aisle last year, things are moving too quickly, right? So how, with that type of workload, are you able in your agency to really do the deep dive into those particulars without that subject matter expertise? Thank you.
Director Larson.
Chair Tolkien, Representative Claiborne. Yeah, it's a really good question. It is inherently the challenge of an office like ours is, how do you have that level of knowledge? Now, with the paid family medical leave, if, as an example, is a little bit different because we've been looking at that one since we were created, or 2020. And so we have a pretty strong understanding of the estimates around that, how the fiscal has been developed, the adjustments to that. So that, like, those, the ones that we see year after year, we get pretty good at understanding. And we work with the agencies, and the agency will sit in the interim and say, hey, let's figure this out a little bit. What can you give us to help us understand? And we certainly do research in other areas. And so if something new comes in, we'll see what's happening in other states, things of that nature. And just to be clear, we say 18 FTE, not all are assigned to fiscal notes. We have some other responsibilities as well. So it's not all 18 just working on fiscal notes. But so that, to your point, the ratio is the 300 is not uncommon of a load for an analyst. In the end, What we have more than anything else is just asking questions, right? It's really like, okay, here's your set of assumptions, and it's my job essentially to go through and pick those apart and say, like, you need to be able to clearly understate so the reader can understand and so that we can verify both the information you're using to develop your estimates and the sources for that information, so we can verify those sources. We'll do some other background research and say, okay, this is happening in another state. Why is this not acting like that? And oftentimes we'll be like, well, we're a different state, and it looks like this because of that. At times, they'll be like, okay, you know, and we'll include that, and we'll readjust our estimate, and that exists too. And so, to kind of building our own expertise in that by area, it really comes down to our staff kind of learning these things over time, doing a lot of work in the interim to kind of grow and understanding our policy area expertise, and also we can just ask questions. Like, that is what we do more than anything else. And we're like, if we can ask the right questions, we get to a point of pretty good saying that seems like a reasonable, accurate estimate. And so that's how we approach the work to be able to answer that question.
Thank you very much, and I do appreciate the work that you do. And I realize that when you ask the questions, depending on the response, right, if you're not getting an accurate response back, then that damages the integrity of the report that you're trying to produce. So thank you very much.
Representative Joachim has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to say, when I first came in with Representative Vogel, too, I was hesitant because it felt like another layer of government. But now I've grown to appreciate having that second eyes on the fiscal notes coming out of the agency. So thank you for the work that you do. I was wondering, too, and Representative Claiborne kind of went down some of the same questioning I had. I had two quick questions. How many were in your office at the LBO when you started? And wondering, with the increase of bills being introduced, has the increase, not only the workload increased, but has there been an increase of requests on unofficial fiscal notes?
Director Larson.
Chair Tolkien, Representative Joachim. So when we were originally created, I think the first live session, I think when we were originally created, there was maybe 7 staff for the office. Before we went live, we got to 11. In that time, we added a position related to local impact notes, but also supports fiscal notes. That work is not as regular, but heavy when it does come in. And then we added 5 additional FTE to support the Tax Expenditure Review Commission. And in that time, we moved positions around a little bit. One of the positions we made for an embedded IT position, which we didn't originally have. And so now we have 4 full-time staff, more or less, on Tax Expenditure Review Commission work, which at the time was projected to be 5. And then we have, I think, at least, including myself and the deputy director, which we do a little bit of everything, The rest of the staff are working on fiscal goals and local goals. So that's kind of how the office is developed. So we went from 11 to 12, or so I think we went from 7 to 11 to 12, and then the Tax Increment Review Commission on, so additional 5. My math is right there. I might be off one. Somehow it's close. We got to 18. So, and I apologize. Now I talked myself out of understanding. What was the question again?
Oh, no worries. No, it's fascinating to hear. I was just wondering, with the increase of the volume of bills, unfortunately, that keep getting introduced, have you seen an increase of unofficial notes requested? And then you sparked another question around local impact notes. I know those can be really hard to figure out. Just who do you end up coordinating with those?
So
Director Larson.
Mr. Torkelson, or Mr. Joachim, in terms of the, I'm so sorry, the first part of the question, now I'm thinking about the second part. I apologize. I'm very sorry. One more time.
Chair Torkelson.
Representative Joachim.
Thank you.
One question at a time would
be
helpful.
Yes, sorry. I have too many things going on in my head right now. So with the increase of more bills being introduced, are you seeing an increase of unofficial fiscal notes? And then you can skip the local impact note. I can ask you about that later. I just know they have a bigger workload.
Director Larson.
Chair Torkelson, Representative Joachim. So we have proportionally unofficial fiscal notes represent between 5% and 10% per year, and that was existed before we were creating the exists now. There's more notes now. The last three sessions has seen a pretty substantial increase in the amount of requests, and so proportionally they've gone up, but they still stay between that 5% and 10% range. I think maybe 11% one year. I think that maybe is our first year, but generally it's between 5% and 10%, and that's been historically about the same, percentageally, proportionally.
Thank you, Director Larson. Members, we're going to give Director Larson a break and bring up Evan Rowe, I'm sorry, Deputy Commissioner of Deed. As we all know, this interchange of information between the agencies and the LBO is critical to the success of an appropriate fiscal note, an accurate fiscal note. And so we'll give, I don't believe that Deputy Commissioner Rowe has a presentation, but we'll give him a few moments to make comments, and then we'll take questions for Deputy Director Rowe. Welcome to committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Evan Rowe. I'm Deputy Commissioner at the Department of Employment and Economic Development. And I, given that Director Larson, I think, already gave a very kind of thorough and detailed presentation, I didn't feel the need to prepare an in-depth set of slides for members. But I can offer maybe just a few comments as a sort of a preparatory effort, and then I'm very happy to answer any questions that members have, of course. I'll just start by saying we absolutely share the objectives of the legislature and the LBO specifically in providing timely and useful information about any sort of fiscal impacts from legislation. It's important to the agencies to be able to model this out and understand what are going to be the operational implications for any program. It's important for members of the legislature to understand kind of implications of how policy changes may lead to fiscal impacts. As I think Director Larson ably noted, it was a very complex set of changes that were proposed in the 2024 legislative session, and there were lots of moving parts. And I think one of the challenges of kind of representing all those changes in one single fiscal note is when you have multiple pieces moving, breaking out the pieces can be challenging when there are different pieces there. Our objective really was to provide the clearest change from the administration's perspective on the implementation of the law based on the proposed legislation as possible. And with that being said, I recognize that there were a lot of complexity and moving parts here, which can make it difficult when you're just trying to get from one place to another. I think when it comes to thinking about how we can kind of work together and more collaboratively and do better going forward, I think Director Larson's points around clear communication and kind of even more proactive communication are certainly something that we're taking to heart here at Deed, and I think across the administration. I think we've had some very good productive conversations with the LBO, with the chairs and ranking members of the committees in question to make sure that we are, trying to be as much on the same page as possible early in the session. I would say that we are also working hard to, make sure that we have the right resources in place to provide timely information to the legislature for this session and beyond as we are developing things going forward. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll conclude here. And
thank you, Deputy Director. Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm just going to go on record as I hate these microphones. Anyway, so to the testifier, I was in committee when you were there, and we paused, and I think then Lead Garofalo met with Chair Olson about the fact that the numbers didn't match up to the language bill, and I think that you made a brief presentation that things were out of phase, and you just said that you were interested in pursuing clear communication. Do you get clear communication when you are moving major pieces of legislation and ginning up new fiscal notes pretty much overnight? Can you help us with that?
Commissioner Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, I guess could you clarify the question? I just want to make sure I can answer it appropriately.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, in committee the day that we're talking about, you had come, and I think it was early in the morning, maybe 10 o'clock-ish, 9 o'clock-ish, somewhere in there, and we were talking about the paid family medical fiscal note. It was being presented to Ways and Means. Chair Olson was giving it a hearing, and right before we started, it was very clear that the fiscal note was out of phase with the data that was in the bill. So there was an author's amendment, and that's where I'm trying to get at, because I know that you and your department were part of generating the information that was in the author's amendment, but it was clearly out of phase with the fiscal note, and I'm just trying to figure out, how is it that the LBO is supposed to generate clear and accurate fiscal notes when the administration and Deed and other organizations are moving faster than the LBO is capable of doing? So maybe if you could help us with that to start off with.
Commissioner Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative, thank you for clarifying the question. I mean, I think, so I wasn't privy to any conversations naturally that occurred between legislators. With that being said, I would certainly agree that it was a very compressed timeline, and to the extent when possible, it is having more time it is valuable in terms of being able to ensure that everybody has a chance to review and ensuring that everybody has sufficient time to review. So I think that that's certainly an objective going forward that we would share.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, Mr. Rowe, you had said early in your presentation just now that you wanted to provide the clearest information possible so that the LBO could make accurate depictions, but you, in one of the assumptions, you went from 0.7 to 0.78, I think in 2 days elapsed time. How can we expect the LBO to generate accurate assumptions, fiscal notes, and so on with that wide of a swing?
Commissioner Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash. Well, if I could clarify just the nature of the permissive authority piece that I think is the 0.70 to 0.78 element that members were discussing previously. So the actuarial analysis in October of 2023 offered two different premium rate scenarios. For the law, one at that 0.70% rate, but as part of Laws 2023 Chapter 59, the section that called for the actuarial study noted that if the actuarial study indicated that the premium rate that was established under the law was not actuarially sound, the commissioner must adjust the premium rate to make the program actuarially sound. The actuarial analysis showed that the premium formula under that law, if you had started it at 0.70%, there would have been a lot of variability in the premium rate kind of yo-yoing around over the subsequent years. And so the actuaries had presented what they viewed to be a more actuarially sound approach, which would have involved setting the commissioner and the agency using its authority to establish that premium rate at 0.78%, which would have provided a more consistent overall premium rate over time, which generally would meet, I think, the principles of actuarial soundness. So I think, you know, in terms of, you know, the purpose of the fiscal note, when a change is being proposed in law, is to measure the change in the from the existing law. One of the challenges, if we had used that 0.70 rate, the first year, I think the rate would have been 0.70. Maybe then the second year, the rate would have been 0.92. Then it would have been it would have moved around a lot, which would have made the base, kind of the change from the base, really hard to compare. By setting it at that 0.78% rate, we were attempting to provide a common base of comparison so that the changes that were proposed in the bill in 2024 would be easier to understand. This is a very long way of explaining. I think what we were really trying to do in using that as the base was to provide a very, a basis for comparison where the effects of the changes would not have been impacted by kind of the swings attributable to the premium formula.
Representative Nash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Rowe, we were rewatching the Senate hearing and it pains me to talk about the Senate, but it's nonetheless accurate. And you had made a statement that as to the premium reset authority, we wouldn't want to have made a big public splashy announcement about something like that, given the fact that there was legislation pending. My question to you is, you just talked about how you're trying to provide accurate information, but you're also saying in your previous statement before the Senate committee that you didn't want to make a big splashy statement that might actually derail the legislation because it was a fairly aggressive 12-point swing in the assumptions. Can you help us understand how you arrived at that statement and how you didn't want to make that statement because it might actually change the outcome of the legislation?
Commissioner Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Nash, I mean, the answer I've not rewatched the Senate committee hearing, but what I guess I would say is when providing, I think the question that the question that I was asked was, why did the administration not kind of go out and kind of converse and kind of put out press, make a big statement about this. And I think the point was there were a number, there was legislation under consideration at the time that would have impacted the program if we had made significant, if we had kind of made significant announcements about the program only for legislation to be passed, that would have, fundamentally altered the program as it did coming out of the 2024 session. We very naturally would have had, I think, some confusion from employers, from applicants, et cetera. And, that would have been kind of detrimental to the program overall. I think the question overall, the question here is, what was the base, what's the basis for the fiscal note comparison, right? For the analysis that was being done under the law, seek to model the changes that were proposed in the bill. So we were certainly trying to provide the best information that we could at the time. But I think what the assumptions that one makes in developing a fiscal note are somewhat different from one's public communication strategy, perhaps as you're working through program implementation. If that helps.
Final question, Representative Nash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and more of a statement. You just said that you didn't want to potentially impact the program before it went out to employers, but it wasn't law yet, and it wasn't moving yet, and the fiscal aspect of this was not finalized, I'll say, since I see Representative Pinto correcting me from the other side of the table. But that part was not done yet, so I guess if you're trying to provide accurate information to the LBO so they can more appropriately provide information to legislators to make an informed decision, wouldn't you want to make it a big splashy statement so that they could see, in fact, that something was headed their way that was vastly different? And 12%, I think, is pretty vast. So I'm just trying to figure out why would you not want to make sure that you made a declarative public statement so that legislators were better informed. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. We'll take that as a statement. Representative Nash. Representative Robinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Rowe. At the beginning of this, you talked about how complex all the changes were. Sorry, I can't see you, so I'm trying to organize myself here. How complex all the changes were, and that it was really hard to communicate and really hard to do the analysis. And, you know, I honestly just take issue with that. The two big changes was the seven-day waiting period and then raising the tax from 0.7 to 0.78, which was done in the fiscal note, not in the statute. It wasn't even contemplated in the statute. And, oh, I just closed it, but I called up the statute you cited saying, oh, you know, the permissive authority was we could do this and make it 25%. Let me see if I can still call it up because it's so interesting. And that was to be done by between January 1st and July 31st of 2026, based on historical data from the program starting. It was never contemplated that it would happen before there was the historical implementation of the program to look at and see what adjustments were necessary. So I find it concerning that your justification for doing this by fiscal note was that, A, it was too complex when really all of us are capable of saying, oh, we're going to increase the tax from 0.7 to 0.78. Not complex. And that you didn't communicate that significant policy change to members, to the chairs of the committee, to the authors of the bill, that you as the agency were just unilaterally doing that. I mean, effectively, it wasn't that you were trying to hide the policy change. It was that you were trying to hide a tax increase in a fiscal note. And I find that very concerning.
Excuse me, motives, please. Let's not impugn motives.
So my question is, when did you internally decide that you were going to have that change in the tax? And how did you communicate that, other than the fiscal note, to the bill authors, to the committee chairs? Was there any other communication other than the fiscal note about a major tax increase?
Commissioner Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Robbins, I guess, first of all, just to kind of take the point, you know, there was the as I was certainly attempting to explain to or explain my response to Representative Nash's question, part of the purpose of establishing that 0.78% assumption was in fact to provide a more consistent base for comparison in the fiscal note, which based on our understanding of the uniform standards and procedures of fiscal notes was to provide a more consistent basis for comparison so that members could understand the fiscal implications of the proposed changes under last year's bills and what is now law. Really it was an attempt by us to provide, to have a reasonable place so that folks would have the information that they need. In terms of decision making, I think that part of the challenge was, it was a session where there were a lot of kind of moving pieces. So I think we were, as we've been working to get the programs stood up, we were in many ways kind of waiting to see what would come out of this, out of the legislative session.
Follow up, President Robbins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Mr. Rowe. So I understand the need for consistency and accuracy and all of it. I support all of that. But I think leaving it at the original baseline of 0.7 and then showing the different levels that proposed legislation would make would provide much greater consistency and accuracy than just bumping it up to 0.78 without any notice. Or the analysis all started at 0.78. If people didn't read the fiscal note, you would think 0.78 was the baseline when that was never, ever in statute anywhere. So to me, it's not accurate. It's not consistent. The consistency and accuracy would have been keeping it at the 0.7 and then allowing policymakers to look at what the different change rates would have had a fiscal impact on. But you built the fiscal impact into the change, and I don't think it's accurate or consistent. Thank you.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Rowe, for being here. Commissioner, going back to, again, a little bit of history of what I was kind of working through as the lead of the workforce in the last 23-24 session. The bill that I mentioned to, again, and I'm hearing a lot of my colleagues really come up with a good point about we just can't have a bunch of fiscal notes getting thrown out. We don't want to do that. I completely agree with that. And again, I'm specific to kind of really one fiscal note that I'm still frustrated about that I never got back. Okay? And so I'm not letting this kind of go because I want some answers, which I haven't gotten yet. But I agree with this tone that we have to make sure. I was the lead of the committee. That should say something for my reasonableness, even for me. What I'm trying to say, though, is why hasn't my fiscal note, and what it was I was looking to say, what would it cost if we were to eliminate a small group of employees under a certain set, like 20? What would it cost the program if there was an exclusion offered up, which was part of my bill? What would that cost? Because I might not have offered the bill, or I would have go, oh, I need to rethink that number. That was the request. It has never been presented or even done. Yet internally, I could see other agencies that were asked that question all responded to my fiscal note, but it doesn't get released until DEED releases it. Can you help me understand, Commissioner, why that wasn't ever done in my case?
Commissioner Rowe.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baker. So I think, and we discussed this a little bit in House Workforce, but just to maybe expand on previous answers. So I believe the fiscal note that you had requested as minority lead last year was an unofficial fiscal note. Is that if memory serves, that's right?
Yeah.
Okay. So I think, and there was a bit of a colloquy between yourself and lead Pinto in that committee, where it was discussed that there was a bit of a conversation about the nature of unofficial fiscal notes and sort of the element to which they kind of the status that they have in law and those pieces. You know, I think from the agency's perspective last year, right? The bill, the bill that you had authored was not scheduled for a hearing, and it didn't have a, there was no, so given kind of the other elements around the other analysis tasks that were before the agency at that point, we weren't able to prioritize that, particularly because I think the bill in question would have required additional actuarial analysis, which would have had a cost to the cost to taxpayers overall. Now, I think I probably could have done a better job providing that information and that explanation. What I would say going forward is, in your position now as chair of the committee, you are able to request fiscal notes, and I think we're already working on a few for you in House Workforce right now. I do think one question though for members would just be, if it is the intent that unofficial fiscal notes, should all be, if any member can request them in that way, and if that does compel agencies to do that work, we share that goal, but there are also kind of resource trade-offs that we have to think about. And I think you did we really appreciated the conversation that we had in the House Workforce Committee about just some of the logistics and effort that is required on that front.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Baker.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, thanks. And again, we've heard a number of times now with the LBO testifying that members should be honored at least with a fiscal reply or something. Again, as I mentioned to the whole committee here too, unofficial requests are that, but if it comes from a lead and it's about a specific bill, that's a big bill. And even since I put my note in back in February of 24, you had two more Milliman notes for updated actuarial studies about other things in the bill that were requested maybe by other members or maybe the chair at that time, which was Chair Zhang. I just, there's no reason why, again, Milliman was engaged after my request. That was available to you if you wanted to ask them about my question as well. I understand in this case, when there's a fiscal note update, in this case, you were paying somebody to do it because the agency wasn't able to really kind of pull the numbers for them. So again, I just, what I don't understand is, what was different is there was an unresponsiveness tone to some groups of us last year. It was very challenging. And I want to make sure whoever's in charge, I don't care who it is, if a lead of a committee or a chair of a committee, especially a chair we get, but if a lead committee or it's a reasonable request and you're not at the end of session, these have to be at least attempted to try to reach something, or you should at least then send a formal letter to the member to say, here's where we're at, why we can't do this. But what happened in this case was, I think, unacceptable. And my final question, Mr. Chairman, is in going forward to with what I heard Director Larson say today, they did not approve the, they didn't kind of, I think approve it is the right word, and if I got it wrong, I apologize, the last kind of fiscal note for paid family as it came out. I would suggest that we as a body start thinking about how do we better alert members if something is not approved by LBO. It should either be stamped a certain way or on a different color of paper, so we kind of understand this is different. Because I do understand 97% of the notes are fine and they're all agreed to, but if they're not, we should have a awareness of this one is different and you should look at it differently. We've got some notes. When we change a bill, we underline things to change a bill. Maybe we can underline things. I'm just saying it should stand out a little bit different going forward on any issue to any agency. But this complex bill that was passed was very complex, did not have fiscal agreements on it internally, and now we're kind of all trying to understand what just happened through that flurry and that movement. And as you said many times, it was moving, and there was a lot of things that were fluid. It was just moving, and we all know when you get going with session, there is no time to really pause. So I just hope that we as members can learn from this, get it better, identify when there's not agreement so we don't have frustrated members that are just still wondering what happened to that fiscal note that was very reasonably requested. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. A final question for Deed from Representative Stevenson, and we have MMB yet to get on the agenda.
Oh, okay. I'll just defer then, Mr. Chair. I had more of a comment. Maybe I'll just save that for the very close of the hearing at that point.
That's great. All right with you. You're released from captivity, and we'll bring up. I get my name. Anna Mingy from the MMB office. She is State Budget Director, and if you would please identify yourself for record, and if you have some opening remarks, please present them to the committee.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. I'm Anna Mingy, State Budget Director and Assistant Commissioner at Minnesota Management and Budget. As you've heard from several folks today, MMB doesn't have an official role or statutory role reviewing agency fiscal notes. You know, that responsibility lies with the Legislative Budget Office. However, we do have a vested interest in the accuracy of fiscal notes as the state's chief financial officer, and you know, as the entity that conducts the biannual budget and economic forecast. Fiscal notes make assumptions about implementation and costs that are used to set appropriations and adjust bills to achieve implementation goals. If fiscal notes aren't accurate, it could mean we don't have a balanced budget, or a program might have more or less funding than we need, which is really important to be aware of in times when we have limited resources. Another reason we care about fiscal notes is to the extent our general fund isn't solvent, that could impact our bond ratings and future surpluses or deficits. As I mentioned, we don't have a role in the fiscal note process, but we take a risk-based approach to monitor and provide input where appropriate. So thinking back in time, what MMB does now is pretty similar to what legislative staff did prior to the creation of the Legislative Budget Office. Generally, our work takes place after a note is completed. For example, if you know we have a team of budget officers who read fiscal notes as a bill is approaching a hearing in a finance committee, and if they read a fiscal note and say, you know, this assumption seems inconsistent with the most recent forecast, we'll reach out to the Legislative Budget Office and the agency to better understand what went into that and potentially make corrections. I would like to echo previous testifiers about the complexities and the unique situations underlying the paid family and medical leave fiscal note, specifically the lack of the baseline, a lack of a published baseline, because this creates creates additional complexity in order to measure the impact of changes associated with proposed legislation. For most programs and most entitlement programs, the baseline is included in the budget forecast, in the November and February forecasts. But the paid family leave program operates in a different part of the state treasury. It's called an enterprise fund. And for folks with accounting backgrounds, which I don't have, but an enterprise fund is not considered a government fund, so it's not part of the consolidated fund statement, which means it's not published in our twice-a-year budget and economic forecasts. However, after the events last year with the sort of evolving baseline for the PFML program, MMB has worked with DEED, so we now do publish an estimate of the paid family leave fund with our twice-a-year budget forecast to help clarify the baseline for the legislature and for the fiscal note process going forward. I'm happy to take any questions, but that's what I have for my prepared remarks.
Thank you. I'm going to ask a question. So much of this conversation today is centered around the rate, the assumed rate at 7% that was been raised. Did MMB play a role in the decision to change the rate from 7.07 to 0.078?
Mr. Chair, the LBO consulted with MMB, as well as I believe fiscal staff, in the sort of the appropriate assumption to use in the fiscal note.
And the timing of that seems to be another critical question here. The original bill set the rate, and it was assumed by many of us that that rate would be in place until the program actually was up and running, and then at that point, there would be an evaluation of whether the rate was appropriate or not. Do you believe that the original rate was ill-conceived?
Mr. Chair, I'm not able to speak to the appropriateness of the original rate, but other than the presence of the actuarial assessment that suggested a different rate in the first year.
Now, as you said, this program is an enterprise program, so the money that's collected, it's kind of like the unemployment program or the workers' comp program, I should say, where the money's collected, the rates are set to keep the fund whole, but yet it has a direct impact on taxpayers. Do you feel MMB has a role to keep taxpayers informed of what their potential liabilities are?
Mr. Chair, I think MMB does strive to provide high-quality information to the public, and I think that's reflected in our decision to start publishing a financial statement for this account going forward.
Well, thank you. I believe that, too. I don't think the average taxpayer spends a lot of time reading fiscal notes. I'm not sure the average legislator spends enough time reading fiscal notes either, as far as that goes, but clear and appropriate communication in a timely fashion is something we should all focus on. I don't have any other questions for you, but Representative Stevenson has. Oh, I'm sorry, I missed you. Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just real quickly, I just kind of want to throw out a little history, being old, I guess. So I find some of this a little funny today because before the LOB, I was in the minority, I was in the majority, and a lot of new members haven't been blessed with that, which is good on them, I guess. But fiscal notes were often historically, you were never happy either, if you, especially if you were in a minority. Often you just, you'd find things that weren't right. So I just kind of feel like, we went out, it wasn't really a surprise to me or
many people I could probably find and bring their voice to this, but when we established the LOB, that we would continue to have maybe that same questioning fiscal notes. And so here we are, and I feel sorry for the LOB in a little bit, because I'm like, you know, we kind of knew this would be coming, and so here it is. And anyways, I just kind of wanted to throw a little sunshine on, you know, fiscal notes historically of, you know, either wherever you're at, you're always, or not always, sorry, that's not right, often you're not quite happy with, you know. Anyways, thank you.
Well, thank you, Representative Lilly. If you're old, what does that make me? No comment?
No comment.
Thank you.
Handsome.
Representative Stevenson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thanks for the discussion today. I think it was good for us to spend some time early in session talking about the fiscal note process and how it can be improved, and I particularly enjoyed the part of the conversation today that reflected how we can do better on fiscal notes. You know, it's important to discuss the past, but sometimes we get a little too focused on it. I did want to comment on a couple of things related to the paid family medical leave that were discussed. You know, last session, I wasn't on this committee, but I was following it pretty closely. And I do recall towards the end of session, things got a little harried, as they always do in every session, no matter who is in control of this place. It always gets a little crazy, and you can go walk and watch tape on either side. But I do recall that when this paid family medical leave bill came to this committee last year, there were some you know, complaints and maybe justifiable complaints from the other side about the speed of things. And I do recall that the chair of this committee then did lay the bill over for several days to allow for further review of that. And we all know, I think, that the bill came here initially on May 10th and left on the 13th over 3 days later, and or 3 days later, I should say. And we all know that that's, you know, about a week before the end of session, where every day feels like a year. So, like, laying over a major piece of legislation for 3 days in the last week of session was a pretty significant accommodation that should be remembered if we're going to litigate this. And the other thing I would mention, I was chair of the Commerce Committee last biennium, and I recall that Republican members pushed very hard, I think correctly, by the way, for an actuarial study to be included in the paid family medical leave bill. What I find it ironic is now that the agency responded to the actuarial study by making changes to make the policy work better, the criticism is that the changes were made in conformance with the actuarial study that the Republican Party was pushing for. I think it's good that the agency, it's good that the study was done. It's good that the agency was responsive to that. The last comment I'd make is that, you know, I heard Director Larson say that he thinks the fiscal note system is working well. There's certainly room for improvement. And again, I'm glad we had this discussion today. But we all play a role in that process as well. And I, you know, a couple members talked about this today, but I just want to stress that I think the potential for great strain this year, and I'm only talking about this year, I'm not talking about what happened in a past year, but the potential for us to place enormous strain on the fiscal note system is immense. Normally, you know, the fiscal note system is more responsive to members in the majority than the minority, but there is no majority, right? So there's another way to look at that is there's 134 people in the majority this year, and there's potential for enormous amounts of fiscal notes. The people in this room, largely, are the people who get to authorize fiscal notes. There's a few others. And sometimes discretion is the better part of valor. I hope that we all exercise restraint in what we ask for fiscal notes this year. And remember that there's a human element on the other side of this, somebody who's got to sit down and figure out how much something costs. And if a bill is not going to happen, is that really the best use of resources? I made a similar comment at freshman orientation this year that I think this should be something we can all unite around. You know, if you're a small government conservative, think about all the tax dollars that are being wasted on fiscal notes on bills that never happened. And if you're a big government liberal, think about those poor government union employees and how they're suffering. We should all be able to say we don't want fiscal notes happening when they're not needed. So I hope we all exercise some restraint. And thanks again for the discussion today.
Well, thank you, Representative Stevenson. Now, you've actually stolen a good portion of my closing remarks, because I do agree with you. I think we as legislators bear quite a bit of responsibility in this area. Timing is important. If you have an idea that you think deserves attention of the LBO, you should get that process started earlier rather than later. because as we all know, the end of session is crazy time, and there's a tremendous amount of pressure on those offices and their people near the end of session. So I will say, though, that there's still the perception often that the administration plays a role in this whole process, and that death by fiscal note is a real thing, and also resurrection by fiscal note, for lack of a better term, is a real thing too. And we should all, throughout state government, be aware of the political implications of the work we do with fiscal notes, and try to make sure that the information is information that's helpful to decision-making, not to our political agendas. With that, members, we are adjourned.